All areas of our life have been affected by the COVID-19 virus, and that certainly includes the stock market. On the show today, we'll get advice from an expert about what you should or shouldn't do. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Frank Armstrong is back with us. He is a certified financial planner and is the founder and president of Investor Solutions. He has more than 35 years of experience in the securities and financial services industry. What investment questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hi, Frank. You with us?
I am, and it's a pleasure.
It is a pleasure to speak with you. So, Frank, market declines are like, well, they're really nothing new, but this one, it just seems so much worse. Is it?
No. You know, we've seen worse, but it's the one that we have in our memory right now.
Sure.
You don't remember it. Back in 1987, I was sitting at my desk, and the market crashed 23% in just a couple of hours. You know, in 2008, 2009 was horrible, and market crashes happen. They always happen for a different reason. The market crash in 2008 was because we had a financial meltdown because we let the banks run willy-nilly into making bad loans that they knew they could never collect.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually that came home to roost. This is a double whammy. We've got a serious pandemic issue in front of us. And the Russians and the Saudis decided to play chicken with the price of oil, and that may have been aimed at our oil production because they can both produce oil a lot lower cost than we can, and they'd like to drive out the shale producers. And this is a surefire way to do it. Get the price of oil was down at $21 or so earlier. It's rebounded today, but. So lots of bad things are going on, and markets simply try and digest the news as they get it and try and forecast what future profits are going to be and then how much risk they want to take to get those future profits. And all that's a moving part with lots of moving parts going on, and fear and emotion get wrapped up in it. And right now we're in the fear cycle and trying to determine just how bad it's going to be. On the other hand, someday people are going to wake up and say, wow, look at those prices. We haven't seen those prices in 5 years. I got to get in. And it'll turn on a dime. It can turn on a dime. I'm not saying that it will necessarily be this so-called V-shaped recovery that we're going to wake up and see the market back at 29,000. But it'll the psychology will change. Most of us are going to live through this. It's going to be really aggravating. We're deliberately shutting down large portions of the economy right now. That's going to impact profits. We don't know how long it's going to last, although it's not going to be forever. 5 years from now, we'll all look back at this and it'll be a distant memory.
Well, thank you for those upbeat words, Frank. I think everybody wanted to hear those. Let's go right to the phones because we have got people with questions on their mind. If you have one, the number 800-642-1234. And as always, you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. First, we have Nick, who's in Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
Hi, I've just got a quick question. I work for a major window manufacturer, and the news is pretty grim. So should I really be putting that $50 a week into my 401k? Or should I be, using it for other things? Because I don't even want to know what my 401k is at now. So
you're not alone, I think, Nick. You're not alone. What should you do?
Everybody ought to have a pretty good cash cushion at all times, because that black swan can swim out at any time. We got a couple of them out there swimming around. If you see them, would you please shoot them? But a good cash cushion is essential to sleeping well at night, mm-hmm. and having a good financial future. Now, how much it should be varies from person to person. Obviously, if you're, let's say, an officer in the United States Air Force, you're not likely to get laid off tomorrow. But, you know, as a window installer, people may stop buying windows and for a while. So, you know, you need to be able to position yourself so you can ride it out. So, yes, I would do what I could to husband my cash.
Okay, so you think that he should probably stop putting things in his 401k at this point, putting money
in. I don't know how much he's got today, mm-hmm. but I think he should look at his cash reserves and make pretty sure that he can go through an extended downturn. Now, of course, you can always borrow against the 401k later, you know, but having it in the bank right now is probably going to be a comfort. And, you know, I like to position my clients so that they can sleep well at night. And that means having a reserve there that's going to tide them through things like this.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So as far as borrowing against that 401k, would you have a penalty you'd have to pay then come tax time, right?
You know, you borrow against your 401k and then you pay it back mm-hmm. at out of your payroll.
Okay.
So that's the standard loan.
Okay.
That there's, as long as you're paying it back, there's no penalty. If you take it out, if you just take it out without doing the borrowing routine, mm-hmm. then yes, there's a 10% penalty if you're under age 59 and a half, and it can be counted as ordinary income, unless you're subject to several of the restrictions or exemptions that are written into the law.
Okay. Thank you for that phone call, Nick. Appreciate that. Next up, we have Jay, and Jay is in Birchwood.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
I'm a state employee, and I've been putting money into a 403B for about 25 years and have a pretty decent amount built up. And then just a few months ago, under the advisement of one of our employees, financial advisors, I moved that into a higher risk fund, and I'm a little concerned. I obviously am not very well versed in this stuff, but I'm concerned about what to do with that, if anything. I do have a halfway decent cash cushion built up. My gut feeling is I just leave it alone and let it ride for now. So what do you think?
Okay, well, a state employee is not as likely as other people to get laid off. That's the good part. The other good part is that, you know, I think people, instead of willy-nilly changing their asset allocation based on tips and stuff, ought to look at where they are relative to retirement time, et cetera. If you're younger and you got plenty of years, I would just go to sleep and forget it. And you might hate me for this advice next year, but 5 years from now, you're going to look back and say, wow, this was great. And so investments you make now in your 403B, you're going to buy at very good prices, and you're going to be forced to dollar cost average in. And unless I was going to retire tomorrow, I would just forget it. And that's, you know, I sound like a broken record. I've been saying this for 47 years to people. But you know what? I've always been right.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, stay in the course has always been the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, panicking and bailing out leaves you with a terrible. In the first thing, you've locked in your losses, and then you've prevented yourself from recovering when the market inevitably recovers. And people are going to go back to work, and this is going to, you know, we're going to recover. We're going to get through this. And so when the day comes, there's not going to be a guy come knock on your door and say, oh, today's the day. Get back in. People wait until it's already up 50%, and then they say, oh, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good about this. And then they get jumped back in.
Sure.
And buying high, selling low, and repeating the cycle until you're broke is not a very good financial plan.
Doesn't sound like it to me, and I'm no expert.
I would stay the course unless I was going to retire tomorrow, and then I would have already built up a pretty good cash cushion mm-hmm. or near cash position.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Jay. So, Frank, so for those who are thinking about retiring in the next year or two, what's your advice to them?
Well, my advice would have been, if we go back in time, to have accumulated a fair chunk of near cash reserves. And I don't mean cash paying 0% today. Mm-hmm. I mean short-term, high-quality bonds that aren't going anywhere. Have a little bit of yield, because we're in a low-yield environment, but that will tide you through the ups and downs of the market. Now, if I was 2 years away from retirement and I had 100% in the stock market, well, I certainly don't think I'd want to liquidate at today's prices, but you've built yourself into a difficult situation, and I don't know how long it's going to take the market to recover. I'm fairly certain it's going to recover, but I don't know. When I say fairly certain, I will tell you it's always recovered before. We got 200 years of data. Markets go down, markets go up, then they go on to new time highs. So I feel pretty good about that long term. But tomorrow's a crapshoot.
Right.
So for everybody out there who's thinking about where they're how they're invested in their retirement plans, if I was getting close to retirement, I would direct enough money into short-term high-quality bonds so that the day I retired, I had a good cushion. I wouldn't sell necessarily what I've got now at the lowest prices we've seen in 5 years.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's just go now to Taylor in Nacoosa. Taylor, you there?
Hi, yeah. Yeah, thanks for having me. This has been a great way to pass the time. So my question is...
Yeah, we're all on lockdown. I'm sitting here.
Yeah, we're all on lockdown.
At home.
Yeah, yeah, appreciate it. Yeah, so I've never invested before, and I don't know a whole lot about investing, but I'm wondering, is this a good time for a first-time investor to get started, and where would you recommend starting in that case?
How old are you?
27.
Oh, yeah. Well, you got a long time before you're going to use this money for retirement, for instance. So you've got great prices looking at you. The market's on sale.
true.
Things are cheap. That's the time to buy. Look, you go to the grocery store and they got a big special on peanut butter. And you say, wow, over the next few years or over the next few months, I'm going to need some peanut butter. Well, you don't run home and throw out all the peanut butter you got at house because it's gotten cheaper. No, you buy more. And that's what you should do with stocks, is when they're cheap, you really want to buy them if you can, as long as you got that cash cushion we were talking about earlier.
Okay. Well, good luck with that, Taylor. She also asked...
She asked where.
Rare, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. To the extent that I was willing to take market risk in stocks around the world, I would go to someplace like Vanguard, and I have no financial arrangement with Vanguard, but I think they deserve a white hat in the securities industry. And I buy the global index. You can buy probably 10,000 or so companies around the world. It's a fully diversified global portfolio. And just until I get a few $100,000 built up in that, that's what I do.
And how much should people really be thinking about when they start to invest? What's the minimum amount that you suggest?
Whatever you can scrape together,
okay.
But if you look at the various brokerage houses and fund companies, the minimum to open accounts and deposit there is very small. And it's not like the old days when everybody, you needed $1,000 or $2,000. You look at Vanguard or some of Fidelity's funds, the minimums are very small. And they've got low-cost, widely diversified passive funds that will diversify your portfolio across whatever portion of the world you want at very reasonable cost.
Okay, great. Next up, we have Patrick in Richland County. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, good morning. Hey, this big cash comfort pile that you're talking about is great. However, when minimum wage is probably about $8 an hour and a grocery cart full of groceries costs over $200. For some families, that's probably not very realistic to have that big cash bundle. However, here's my question. In all your years of advising, when have you ever advised people to sell their stocks?
You know, I don't make that decision based on market timing. I make it if they have concentrated stock position. Let's say you came in here and you owned only Exxon stock or only General Motors or only, you know, two or three stocks. I would say, okay, you need to diversify this because something could happen in one of those firms. We don't know, you know, but at one point GE was going to take over the world and IBM before that. And they didn't. And Amazon came along, and nobody had heard about them. And Microsoft, nobody had heard about them. I once remember a number of years ago sending a computer back because it came with Microsoft DOS. I said, no, I'm not. I want IBM DOS. Okay, so, you know, the world changed.
Yes, it did.
And diversification prevents you from making really bad bets on individual stocks. Now, the other time is that if you're going to retire, let's say X number of years from now, rather than sell, I would just switch my allotment into short-term bonds or bonds portfolio to reduce my risk, and so I had a balanced account the day I wanted to retire. But no, I don't. I'm not saying, oh, I think the world is going to end in a handbasket. We're all going to die, so let's sell stocks. That is a strategy that has almost never worked before. I mean, it works for 1% of the time, but I kind of prefer a strategy that works 100% of the time, which is stay the course.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that question. And what he had mentioned about, you know, it's difficult for people to put aside any money to invest. What do you tell people when they express that opinion to you?
I think I sympathize with them entirely. I think they're in a very difficult position. You know, without getting too far into politics, I think it's absurd that somebody would be working for $8 an hour anywhere. I think the minimum wage hasn't gone up nearly enough to account for that. If somebody works 40 hours a week, steady job, they ought not to be on welfare. They ought not to be on food stamps. They ought to have a decent financial condition, but that's a political decision. Mm-hmm. But I know if I've got to pay another 40 cents for my McDeath burger, I don't care. I want the guy making that burger to live a decent life.
Okay. We're talking with Frank Armstrong. He's a certified financial planner and is the founder and president of Investor Solutions. What investment questions do you have? We have open lines, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phone. We've got Owen in Wauwika waiting. Hi, Owen.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm a young farmer, and I currently rent. I don't own any real estate, and I've been kind of waiting for the markets to change a little bit and make it a little bit easier for me to justify spending money on land. Do you think there's any chance of this happening now, or is it way too early? I'll just let you know a little bit about what I have. I have good credit. I have really all my equity is in livestock and equipment, but I don't have any, well, a little bit of cash on hand. But I'm looking to buy some land and instead of investing in the markets. So do you think that would be a good idea?
I can barely spell farm. I grew up on a family farm in New Hampshire, and I've loaded hay and herded cows and milked cows and all that stuff, but I'm not an expert on farm economy. I will tell you interest rates are low if you want to go to the, but when you leverage up to buy land, eventually you've got to pay it. And if food prices go down or whatever your crop happens to be gets overproduced, you could be in a bind. A lot of farmers are. And, you know, it's way beyond my area of expertise. And so I, you know, advice is cheap, but good advice is harder to come by. And I can't give you good advice here. I really don't know what the risks involved in levering yourself to buy land would be, or when the price of land might fall. You know, part of it's political. If they cut the ethanol subsidy, then the price of land is going to go down, obviously. And those are decisions I don't get to make. That's made above my pay grade, as we used to say in the Air Force. So I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to help on that issue.
All right.
Well, good luck to you.
Yeah, good luck to you. And, you know, ask around. Ask your fellow farmers and see what they think, because they've been through it, obviously.
Yeah, they're a better source than I am.
Sure, sure.
And the bankers in town have got some idea about the risks and rewards of that. I mean, they've been through it a lot.
Yep, ask a lot of questions. That's always important. That's what I always say. And we've got someone who else wants to ask you a question, and that's Dale in Waukesha. Hi, Dale.
Hey, Dale.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. What's your question?
My question is, I'm 59 and a half, a little over that, and I just received a packet from that I have a pension benefit plan from a hospital I used to work at, and I can wait till I'm 65 and get the $165 a month. Or I can take a lump sum of like $15,000. And my thought is, well, I could roll that into my 401k, especially now with the stocks being so much lower, it might be a better time to do that. And if it's in my 401k, at least my family, if I pass away, they get it. Whereas if it stays with the pension plan, once I pass away, it's gone. Is that a good idea?
It would be unusual for you to have zero death benefit in the pension plan. I would take a look at that. But yes, if I had a zero death benefit in my pension plan, I would roll it into a 401k. But then the other decision is, what does $15,000 or whatever the terminal benefit is buy you on a monthly basis at, say, 5% per year versus the retirement package you could get, and what are the options? If you took an annuity from it at some point, one of the things you could do is provide that your spouse or family member have a continuing benefit if you die before some period of time. There's a lot of options there, and they're you'd have to look at your individual package, but if it really truly does have a zero death benefit, then yeah, rolling it out of there makes a lot of sense if you're concerned about your family down the road.
All right. Thank you, Dale. If you've got a question, we've got open lines, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. There's probably
Let me interrupt. Go ahead, Frank. If I were you, I would take that package to a decent financial planner and go through what the options are and just make sure you understand them before you commit. You don't want to look back and say, boy, that guy on the radio gave me. he didn't know what my plan was, and he didn't know what my situation is, and I didn't understand what I was doing, and this didn't work out very well. You don't want to be there. So get some good help.
Mm-hmm. That really is important, because it is kind of confusing. I was going to ask, let's just pedal back all the way, and let's talk about the market basics. What is the whole idea behind a market?
Well, a market is a bundle of stocks when you look at it. Say, and it could be the S&P, which is 500 large stocks, or the Dow, which is only 30, or it could be the NASDAQ, which is high tech to a large extent in smaller firms. But it's a bundle of stocks. But each one of those is a portion of it, and the price of that stock is made by a collective judgment about what the future prospects for profits in that company are and how much risk are associated with those profits. And if it's a highly risky asset or company, then they will discount that price by a bigger number than if it's a very safe company. So let's say you suggested that you thought they were going to make a dollar a year forever. Well, you might be willing to pay $6, say, for that, and that would give you a pretty high return. But if it was highly risky, actually the numbers would be more like $25, say, for a dollar a year profit. If it was highly risky, then you might only, and you weren't assured that you were going to get to the dollar per year forever, you might only be willing to pay $15 or $10 for it. In any event, billions of your closest friends are making those judgments in real time, and a whole bunch of really smart computers are doing it too. And so they come to a collective judgment, the wisdom of crowds. And that sets the price of an individual stock. And when you multiply that by 500, you get the price of the S&P 500 or the variations of it. And as new news comes into the system, all those billions of your closest friends are making instant decisions based on that new news, and the price of the stock will go up and down. But the other thing to keep in mind is that risky assets, when they're diversified, pay a great deal more than safe assets. Today, if you go to the Treasury Department, you're going to be lucky to get 1%, and that's a really safe asset. And so what happens is people will expect that if they will tolerate the risk, going up and down and riding through things like this, they'll get 6%-ish more than that 1%. So looking forward, the stock market might pay 7%-ish, and that's a whole lot better than close to zero. So, but the price is, you got to put up with this aggravation.
It's the cost of making money, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's how the market prices things, is how much risk is involved in getting this return. And you can diversify away individual company risk, like earlier we were talking about General Motors and GE and IBM. You can diversify that away, but you can't diversify away market risk. The market's going to go up and down, and your stocks are most likely going to go up and down with it. And that risk is something you're going to have to be willing to tolerate in order to get the higher return.
Okay, great. Next up is Margaret in Portage. Hi, Margaret.
Good morning. I have a question. If you have your money, say, example, in Prudential, and you want to move your money to, say, example, Merrill Lynch, at this time, is this a good time, or are there charges involved?
I don't know what Prudential's back-end charge is or what you hold at Prudential. If you have a Prudential annuity.
Those are just examples.
Okay, well,
if you're with a provider and you want to move it to somebody else.
Well, if it's an annuity, there's more than likely a back-end charge for the first several years you hold it. And so that would cost you. If, let's say, though, you just wanted to move it from Schwab to Fidelity Brokerage, there wouldn't be any cost. The more important decision is what you hold at the present time. You could make the same changes if you were, let's say you were at Schwab, you could make the same changes in your portfolio there as you could at Fidelity, and there's no big reason to change between one or the other. On the other hand, if you're at a high-cost brokerage or if you're in products that cost a lot to or providers that charge you a lot to administer your account, then probably you want to take a look at moving. But again, I don't know what you hold. I don't know what the cost of holding them is versus where you could get a better deal. And so that's, again, something you need to think through, and maybe you need to get some professional advice.
Okay. Thank you so much for that question, Margaret. We are talking with Frank Armstrong, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Lee Rayburn is our technical director today, and Dean Knetter is our on-air producer. And we are back with Frank Armstrong. He's a certified financial planner and is the founder and president of Investor Solutions. Let's go right back to the phones, Frank. First up is Jane in Wausau. Hi, Jane.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is, we have to take RMDs from our 401 accounts. And in December of 2019, the markets were up. So what we have to take in 2020 is much more than what we've done in the past 2 years. So to get those distributions, we, of course, are selling that stock now at a much lower price. Is there any way to minimize this? Should we be looking at changing the timing of those distributions or something?
No, the distribution is set by the value of the price on December 31st times a factor that reflects your age. And so, you know, you could take the distribution and reinvest it. And after taxes, you'll just reinvest at the lower prices. But you're going to have to take cash. You can't take it out in kind. So I guess I would lean towards taking it now, reinvesting the difference between what you get and the taxes you pay at the lower prices.
And can't she take some of that and give it to a charitable foundation?
Yes, you absolutely can. You can use your RMD for a charitable deduction. No, it's not. I misspoke. It's not a deduction. It goes directly to the charity, and it doesn't get added to your taxable income.
Okay.
And those are something many of our clients set up to do every year. But if you need the money or you don't care to make a charitable deduction or distribution, then you just take the cash and reinvest it.
Okay. Thank you, Jane, for that question.
You know, let's say you have to take out $10,000 or some number. If you were to take it out now and buy at the lowest cost, you'd probably be happier than if you waited till the end of the year and the stock market prices were higher. But I can't really forecast what the stock market prices are going to be at the end of the year. That's something you have to kind of work through yourself. But today, I think you got a great opportunity to invest at low costs.
All right. Next up, we're going to Bob in La Crosse. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's up?
I have a question. My question is, I worked at a place for 30 years, and I had a 401k, or I have a 401k. And when the market was at 29 on the Dow, I don't know why, but I did what they call parking it. I took the whole amount, and I parked it. And that's sitting there, so I didn't take no hits on it. But I've had a new job for about 2 years. They have a 401k, and I put 25% with a 3.5% match in that. I'm wondering if your advice would be to maybe up that if I could, or should I invest some of my other one back into the market or let it sit?
I'm a little confused. When you say parked it, you parked it in a cash type account?
Yes, and it's at 2.8% is where it's been at, drawing at it, yes.
Okay, well, you know, you could say to yourself, wow, this is a great opportunity to buy. Or you could say to yourself, this may be a great opportunity to buy, but I don't know, so I'm going to put a quarter of it in now, and I'm going to wait for a quarter and do another quarter, et cetera, et cetera. Or you can leave it there. You know, that's if it's netting you 2% and some, that's not all bad in a zero interest rate treasury market. you know, it's discouraging to see interest rates so low, but
yes, it is.
But you know, I can remember when people high fived at cocktail parties when they got a 14% mortgage, but they think of that as the good old days somehow.
Yeah,
and that was an indication of an economy that was really stressed.
That was back in, what, the late 70s, mid-70s?
Yeah, right.
Okay. All right, Bob. Well, good luck with that. And
So anyway, Bob, back for the new contributions, you know, depending on your age, what What you really need to do, what everybody needs to do, is determine what their asset allocation should be across all the assets that they own, so that they're comfortable, they've got a good, that it's not too risky, so that they can sleep at night, and that it's going to grow enough to support them in retirement, and come to a decision that's unique to your needs. But you can't get into mental accounting and say, well, I'm going to do safe stuff here and risky stuff here. You really need to say, okay, I got X number of dollars across all my accounts, and where's the best place to look at that entire pile of money and invest it? How should the entire pile be invested instead of cutting it down into little tiny pieces?
Okay, thank you. And Ron in Madison is next. Hi, Ron.
History. The farmers who got locked into 18% spring planting loans in 1980, if they couldn't pay off every penny in the fall, it rolled over and stayed at 18% year after year after year. And by 1986, it had killed off many thousands of family farms. Okay, my question.
Ouch.
Is Warren Buffett's advice still good? That's why so many of them went broke in 86 and 5 and 7. Warren Buffett left instructions for his wife. When he dies, put 90% of the money into Standard & Poor's 500 index funds and the other 10% into bond mutual funds. For people near the middle of the income wealth curve, I figure 50% into S&P 500 index and 50 bonds. But should I hedge? Should I diversify and put some into an index fund with real low management fees that invests in NASDAQ, not the 500 on the New York Stock Exchange, but get into the NASDAQ exchange?
You could get the QQQ, or you could buy a small company stock or a small company value ETF or mutual fund, I meant, and that would give you wider diversification than the S&P. In practice and in economic theory, the big safe companies are going to have a lower expected return going forward over the rest of your life, probably, than the smaller companies. Smaller companies are going to be more volatile, but should end up with a higher return. And that doesn't work for years at a time, but if you look at it, if you look back at it 25 years from now, you'll probably be pretty happy you diversified away from a completely large company stock portfolio. The other way to diversify is to buy some foreign assets, and you can buy large and small in the foreign markets too. And the other thing you mentioned is low cost ETFs and mutual funds, and that's the only way to go, in my humble opinion. And if you've been listening to the show for the last half hour, you know I don't have any humble opinions. But I'm a big advocate for low-cost, widely diversified funds, whether they're mutual funds or ETFs.
Okay, thank you, Ron. Next up is Russ in Stoughton, and he has a question. I'm not sure if this is in your wheelhouse or not, Frank, but let's go. Hi, Russ.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. There has been so much information lately in the media, newspapers, and all. And I was wondering if you knew if there had been a final decision on if everybody or just some filers are going to get the 90-day tax extension this year without penalties and all everything that goes along with that.
I think everybody gets the extension. You don't. You got to pay eventually, but I think the latest thing I saw is everybody gets the extension.
But you do have to
penalties.
File before the 15th, correct?
I'm not sure. I'm going to plead.
Yeah, I thought I read something on the New York Times today that said that you get an extension for paying, but you still have to file by April 15th.
You can always file an extension.
Right, yeah.
And that goes to October sometime.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
The question is, do you have to pay? And the answer is no. You get an extension to pay, and it's interest and penalty free. you know, you need to talk to an accountant or a tax preparer or a tax service, because I'd rather die than fill out somebody's 1040.
I'm glad we do have people that do. And actually, Lee, just our engineer here, just looked it up, and tax payments are due now on July 15th if you owe, but you still have to do your filing by April 15th. So even
good
if
for
you,
him.
Yeah. So
it's great to have good help, isn't it?
It's awesome to
thank
have
you, Lee.
Great help.
Google knows everything.
Right. And Dean in our call booth says that he had a different source, and that is true. So two good sources for us.
Awesome.
We are a team. And we're here to answer your questions. So if you have any, give us a call, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email, which is ideas@wpr.org. And we did get an email from Dan, and he asks, if someone's money is running out, are there any tips on pulling funds out of an IRA or a 401k, or maybe tapping into home equity? And have you heard if the pandemic is being qualified as a hardship with regards to retirement plan withdrawals? So lots of questions there, Frank. You want to take the first one about the IRA?
Well, you can always take money out of your IRA and pay the taxes until it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
That's always an option. If you're over 59 and a half, there's no penalty. If you're under, then there are some exceptions to the penalty rule. Then home equity, a reverse mortgage is something that you may want to consider. We're not experts in those so much. There may be other ways to sell assets or but a reverse mortgage works for some people. You got to be careful you understand it, and don't get.
What about a line of credit, Frank?
You got to have some assets to pledge against it.
Right, the home equity.
That's a home equity loan, as opposed to a reverse mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not just going to give you money, a line of credit, unless you've got. Assets to pledge against it.
Sure, sure. And then have you heard if the pandemic is going to be qualified as a hardship for retirement plan withdrawals?
They're fighting that in the U.S. Senate and House today. But the only thing we have is one bill that was signed, and it doesn't have anything to do with that. They now want to give everybody $1,000 or $2,000 a month to get them through this, and that probably makes a great deal of sense. You can't let the entire economy collapse. And we are displacing millions of people from their jobs. And if they stop buying stuff because they got no money at all, then everybody else who's still working is endangered. And we go into a tailspin. In my lifetime, deliberately shut the economy down or big portions of it. And so we have to develop a safety net, not only for the benefit of the people who are impacted, but to maintain the health of the economy so that when the pandemic goes away, everybody's going to be able to restore their lives, get back to work. And in the meantime, demand will have been enough to keep us going.
Okay.
You don't want to see a tailspin develop.
No, because you pretty much think recession is inevitable, right, for right now?
I think we're probably already in a recession with all these people out on the streets, but that data lags by a month or two.
Okay, well, you know what? We can discuss that a little bit when we come back, but we do have to break right now for news. We're talking with Frank Armstrong. He's a certified financial planner and is the founder and president of Investor Solutions. What investment questions do you have for him? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And you are listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, filling in for Larry this week. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Frank Armstrong is back with us. He's a certified financial planner and is the founder and president of Investor Solution. And he has more than 35 years of experience in securities and financial services industry. What investment questions do you have? Please give us a call, 800-642-1234. And you can always send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Frank, I think maybe that 35 years plus is a little bit low, isn't it?
It's 47 years.
47.
What's 12 years amongst us?
Oh, my gosh. I'll update all of that information. We will credit you as we should next time. I was listening when I was reading that. I was like, that can't be right anymore. So well, anyway.
I think it was the first time I came on your show.
I think you're years. Right. No one's updated it. Oh, my.
Larry and I have been going steady for a long time.
You have. You've both been around a long time. Thank goodness. We appreciate that. So we were talking about recession before we went to the break. And just kind of mention it again, what your thoughts are on that. You think we're already in one?
Well, I think when you put all these people out of work suddenly overnight, the economy is going to shrink. You got to be delusional to think it's not shrinking right now.
Right.
It's deliberately being shrunk. In order to prevent the pandemic from getting worse. We're behind the eight ball on that. And reasonably desperate things are going to have to be done. And we're all going to have to cooperate. But part of it is people are going to be put out of work. And then now we've got to develop a safety net for those people so that the economy doesn't implode. But yeah, I think all that data lags.
Mm-hmm.
You're not getting minute by minute updates on who's unemployed and what the store sales are. I mean, when Macy's shuts down nationwide, you know that's a problem.
Yes,
they're not going to have very good sales this month, right?
Right.
So then all that stuff gets to reported. It's going to be a while, and then we're going to say, oh, it wasn't a very good month, and yes, we're probably in a recession. But I think it's deliberately induced, and with wise strategies, it will be short, and the recovery will be robust.
Okay. Let's go back to the phone, because we do have a couple of callers waiting. Josh in Stevens Point is first. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What's your question?
Well, I understand that we have a delayed payment of taxes. We still have to file by 4/15. Part of my tax plan, overall tax plan, is to invest in a IRA and SEP and is going to require quite a bit this year for 2019. Do I have to make that investment in the SEP and IRA prior to 4/15 or by 4/15, or can I delay that as well? I'm going to have to transfer some monies from other accounts and wondering if I have to realize that loss on those accounts so I can invest it in the SEP. I'll take my answer off the air and have a great day.
Realizing the loss would allow you to have a tax benefit called tax loss harvesting. That may not be the worst thing in the world. I'm not a tax expert, but my understanding is that you can make the IRA contribution until you file. But ask an expert. Don't rely on this particular answer. Okay.
All right. Let's go to Jim in Northwest Wisconsin. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Hello?
Yeah. What can we help you with?
Well, I'm retired. My wife is still working. We had... we were not in debt whatsoever, and we had a fairly good 401s going. We had one that we're not contributing anymore, and we had another one that my wife still contributes to. They're about the same. You know, it was like $500,000, a little better. So when this hit, and of course it started crashing, and like in 6 days, we took the one that we're not contributing anymore, and we moved it all to the lowest risk fund we could and just left it there. And the other one we just left alone. And that's in pretty well diversified, and it's more of a medium. There is some foreign stock and, you know, a lot of S&P, you know, more of the stock that usually does pretty good. We just left that alone because she's still contributing 23% to that. Now, of course, that's losing. But was that smart to do that, or should we have put it all in the lowest risk thing we could have, and then whatever she contributes from now on until she retires in 4 or 5 years, leave that alone in the higher risk fund?
I would finish your question. Sorry.
No, I think we're good, Frank. Go ahead.
Okay, well, you know, the contributions you're putting in now, you're buying at extremely good prices. And even if the markets continue to go down for a while, you're getting even better prices. So you ought to be celebrating that. And if you were fortunate enough to have a cushion that is in safe assets now, that's not the worst thing in the world either. But again, the rational way to go about this is to say, okay, the family is worth X number of dollars, and we want to have an asset allocation that might be 60% stocks and 40% bonds, or 80% stocks and 20%, and to build towards that and stay the course until your family situation changes, not the economic situation, but the family situation changes. Like you get closer and closer to retirement, you may want to have a larger cash cushion or near cash cushion. But you know, I think if for people who are contributing to 401ks, they ought to do is put as much as they can in now, given that they're not going to retire for X number of years. They're getting to buy at great prices. Stock market's on sale.
And I love a sale.
Fill your basket with it.
Yeah, I love
fill
a sale.
Fill your basket, man.
Yeah, forget about the toilet paper. Buy stocks, right? All right. Thank you, Jim. If you've got a question, 800-642-1234. We can always take an email also. ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, Marilyn emailed us. She wants to know, when the stock market goes down, is there someone buying those stocks? And where does the money go when the market drops?
Okay. Yeah, that's a great question. For every seller, there's a buyer. And for everybody who's panicked today and said, oh, my God, I want out, there's a guy saying, wow, these are great prices. and so, yes, there's the values go up and down. But the money doesn't really go anywhere, because if I sell my stock, somebody else on the other side buys it. And I'm selling because I'm afraid, and he's buying because he's greedy. More than likely, he's going to be right. Unless you've got a pressing cash need today,
mm-hmm.
But in the long haul, selling while it's down is not a great decision. And guys who are willing to take the risk have a much higher anticipated return going forward. I mean, anytime you can buy stocks cheap, your expected return is better than if you're buying at the top of the market. So it's a great opportunity for people with cash that they're willing to employ to buy. But no, for every piece of stock out there, at the end of the day, somebody owns it. It don't just vaporize and float around. Somebody owns it. And so if you, for every seller, there's a buyer, and vice versa. So no, it doesn't just float away.
And the money that she's like, where's the money go when the stock market drops? And this isn't real money, is it?
It's, you're buying shares in a company, and you know, you, let's say it's IBM or Apple or whatever. The value that people are willing to buy Apple stock at goes up and down, but Apple's still there doing whatever they're going to do. And their future profits may go up and down a little, but Apple hasn't gone anywhere. You're buying a share of a company. You're not buying dollars.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go next to Dennis in Milwaukee. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning. See, my question is buying into Bitcoin's a good investment?
Ooh, that's an interesting question, Frank.
that's more of a speculative operation that I would be comfortable with. It goes up and down based on It has no intrinsic value. You can't point to anything that you own. To some extent, you're relying on a greater fool to come along and buy at a higher price. And the volatility has been very high. The more interesting part of the Bitcoin transaction is that cyber currencies will allow us to get, when they become established, they will allow us to buy and sell for people who don't have bank accounts, for instance, bypass the banks and do transactions a lot cheaper. And the software behind them is extremely useful for a whole variety of uses other than finance. So the software is certainly an asset that is going to be useful. A particular coin like Bitcoin or whatever may or may not be a good investment. It's a speculation. It's not an investment. There's nothing you can point to. You don't own anything. It doesn't have any return except for the fluctuation in value. It's not something I would do, obviously there's buyers and sellers out there who are doing it, but it's not my bailiwick. I wouldn't put a penny in it, although I think down the road, cyber currencies are going to be an important part of the world economy and liquefy financial transactions in a very significant way and allow a lot of people to participate who don't have bank accounts. I mean, think of today if you use your phone to buy or something, you know, Apple Pay, you're ultimately using a bank account. And if you could bypass that bank account, the cost of that transaction goes down. But even though we know that there's going to be somebody win, we don't know who they are. It could be Bitcoin, it could be one of the others, or it could be somebody we've never heard of today.
Oh, great. Thanks for that question, Dennis. That's pretty interesting. Mary emailed...
It's fascinating. I love it, but I'm not investing in it.
Yeah, that's kind of the way I look at it, too. Mary emailed to say that she's contributing 25% to her 401k. She can afford to contribute 100%. Is now a good time?
Yeah, great prices. I mean, if you're not retiring tomorrow... next year or whatever. If you've got a long term time horizon, say 7 years, you want to be socking it away at what are great prices. And if next year the prices are even better, go for it, because you know the sun always rises after these
spring
dark
always
nights.
Comes, right?
It yeah. always comes. It always has.
Yeah.
And if it don't, we got more problems than what our 401k is invested
true.
In, right?
Very true. Very true.
But it's always been a good idea to buy when prices are, to dollar cost average in and take advantage of low price stocks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And next up, we have Karen in Portage. Hi, Karen.
Hi, this is Karen.
From Portage, yeah, go right ahead.
Well, actually, I'm from Madison, Wisconsin. But I was just thinking about this, and it with the stock market, is it same as with the distribution of wealth in this country that the majority of what goes on in the stock market is really benefiting a small percentage of, you know, of the people, whereas 70% or whatever are not affected.
Okay.
I think we're tangling the question a little. First of all, everybody that's got a 401k is benefiting from, or an IRA is benefiting from the stock market over the long haul. Not today, they're not, but you know they will benefit from it. Having a stock market means that we can share investment risk widely amongst people and encourages capitalism. And people who don't necessarily even have a penny may have jobs in companies that are issuing stock. And so capitalism is on balance, a very good thing. You can't. But yes, there is an imbalance of wealth and income, but it's not the fault of the stock market. There are other ways to level that out, without saying, "Oh, the stock market's bad," because lots of rich people own lots of it. It's those rich people have provided capital that supports the rest of the people who don't even have a penny in there, and that's the good part. There is a subset of capitalists who would kill us all to make one more nickel of profit, and those people need to be regulated. We don't want to do away with capitalism, but we do want to regulate the bad actors. This is my own personal value judgment, but I am an economist, and I'm a 100% capitalist in a regulated environment, so that gross bad behavior is not encouraged.
Okay. We did have a couple of people who were interested in socially responsible investors, so that they don't invest in like fossil fuels or nuclear weapons, stuff like that. Is that true that there are, you know, funds like that? And
oh, sure, okay. there's great funds like that. Mm-hmm. The devil's in the details for people who really want to get into it. Socially responsible funds vary from fund to fund. We have one fund company that we represent that's based their socially responsible fund on pretty much Catholic values. Now, Catholic values are something that the vast majority of Americans would look at. They don't have to be Catholic, and they'd say, okay, I can buy into most of this. No guns, no drugs, no, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so that's one type of fund. Another type of fund, though, is designed to be to encourage environmental practices, and they avoid the worst actors across all the sectors. They wouldn't buy a company that had big oil reserves, for instance, because that oil is going to get pulled out of the ground and burned someday. And they're looking for funds that they're screening out the worst actors, the worst parts of the economy that contribute to environmental pollution and global warming. Other socially responsible funds are counting the number of women on the boards, or they're counting, you know, the number of gays on the board or whatever. So there's hundreds of funds, and you have to pick and choose to match your values. The other thing I'll tell you is that you can still have widely diversified, low-cost funds, which wasn't true 5 or 10 years ago. Socially responsible funds were not particularly well-diversified, and they were extremely high-cost. And like other funds, in order to be competitive, they've cut their prices down to where they're competitive with other funds, and they apply screening criteria that meet various people's needs so that they can invest with their values. You shouldn't believe, however, because one fund doesn't buy Exxon, that anybody else cares. Other people are going to buy Exxon, and you might be providing them an opportunity. So it's not a panacea. It's not going to change the world, but I think indirectly it forces companies to be more responsible and maybe have better social policies. But it's not a panacea. You can't just buy a fund and change the world.
Frank, we've got a couple minutes left. How can the government assist with this recovery?
Well, the first thing they need to do, and everybody knows it, is to start testing people, isolating people that test positive, and supporting them get more respirators. The CDC has covered all that stuff. The other part, though, is to loosen up the financial system so that people who are impacted get steady paychecks to tide them through, so that demand doesn't collapse. On the monetary side, they can flood the – and they are. They're flooding the world markets with currency so that financial transactions can be greased and people can afford to borrow money, et cetera, et cetera. So you have fiscal policy on one side where, for instance, they want to start passing out checks, which may be a pretty good thing. And you have monetary policy where they're making sure that there's adequate reserves out there, adequate funds out there to facilitate the operation of the entire global economy while we nurse ourselves through this. So, yeah, there's a lot of things they could do. And those are the kinds of things that I believe are being debated right now in the Senate House bills.
There were some things that were passed earlier this week. What did you think about those efforts?
Those were not designed to benefit the broad economy. They were kind of emergency procedures to directly implement help on the health side.
Mm-hmm. So
they're not generally stimulus type. And so the general stimulus and the bailouts, you're going to hear about airline bailouts, for instance. But, you know, those are good companies running good businesses, and it's not their fault that the pandemic come along. You know, unless you want to contemplate life without an airline system, you got to give them some support. And the same with the cruise ship companies and other people, retailers. If you don't give them some kind of bailout, they're going to disappear. Delta's just grounded 300 airplanes. Just imagine the capital cost of putting 300 airplanes at $50 million to $100 million a copy on the ground and sitting there.
Okay. Well, Frank, thank you so much for being with us today and for giving us some hope on the stock market. We appreciate that.
It always recovers. It always has.
Excellent. And this time tomorrow, Garden Talk, we'll have Neil DeBole back with us to help you with your prairie garden questions. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau.